including Denmark. Denmark has to have us have Greenland, and we'll see what happens. But if we don't have Greenland, we can't have great international security. The US delegation took off from Maryland, and we're due to fly directly to the American military base in northwestern Greenland. The US gained a military base after a 1951 defense agreement between Denmark and the United States. The delegation's plans were hastily rescheduled just days before to cut out visits to the capital, Newark, and a dog sled race in Sisimiut after widespread outrage in Newark and Copenhagen over the unsolicited trip. Originally, the Second Lady Usha Vance was scheduled to travel without the Vice President. America's national broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. Vice President J.D. Vance said on Friday, 28th of March, during a day trip to a U.S. base in Greenland, that the Trump administration doesn't think that military force is ever going to be necessary there, just the same day that President Trump said, "We have to have Greenland." J.D. Vance visited the Pituffik Space Base, the northernmost U.S. military installation, along with Second Lady Usha Vance, National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, Secretary of Energy Chris Wright, and Senator Mike Lee of Utah. While there, the Vice President blasted Denmark for its handling of the island, as the Trump White House eyes the semi-autonomous Danish territory despite opposition from residents and leaders. While J.D. Vance was there, President Trump reiterated his strong desire to acquire the Arctic island. Trump said, "We need Greenland very importantly for international security." Speaking to reporters in the White House, Donald Trump said, "We have to have Greenland. It's not a question of, do you think we can do without it? We can't." Donald Trump hasn't ruled out military force in Greenland, while Vice President J.D. Vance on Friday said he believes the people of Greenland will seek independence from Denmark. A reporter asked J.D. Vance if his message is consistent with President Trump's message. Vance said the president wants more of a U.S. presence in Greenland, but the president has said clearly he doesn't think that military force is going to be necessary. J.D. Vance added, "What we think is going to happen is that the Greenlanders are going to choose through self-determination to become independent of Denmark, and then we're going to have conversations with the people of Greenland from there on," Vance said. "So I think talking about anything too far in the future is way too premature. We do not think that military force is ever going to be necessary. We think this makes sense. And because we think the people of Greenland are rational and good, we think we're going to be able to cut a deal. The deal, Donald Trump style, will ensure the security of this territory, but also it will ensure the security of the United States." J.D. Vance said his trip to the base helped him see close up how critical Greenland is for America's national security. "If an enemy fired a missile on the United States, it would be the American soldiers at the Greenland base who would alert their countrymen," he said. Vance also reiterated that the United States knows that both Russia and China are taking a serious interest in the Arctic, and he said the U.S. needs to make sure it's leading in the Arctic. J.D. Vance also recognized Denmark has been an important security partner in the past, but he launched criticisms of Denmark, saying the U.S. base in Greenland is less secure than it was decades ago because of Denmark's stewardship.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Cradle News Roundup, your one-stop shop for all news West Asia. My name is Esteban Carrillo. I am the news editor for The Cradle. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and writer for The Cradle, Karim Shami, and content creator and social media manager for The Cradle, Sima Itayim. So as we start today, it's been almost 1 week since Israel unilaterally ended the ceasefire in Gaza, dropping heavy airstrikes across the entirety of the strip, killing at the very least 730 people, nearly half of them children. The death toll continues to climb. As we speak, one of the latest casualties was Al Jazeera correspondent Hossam Shabat in the north of Gaza in Jabalia camp, one of the most important voices coming from inside Gaza. The Israeli occupation army targeted him directly from what we're hearing. At the same time, sources to Al Arabiya Al Jadid say that ceasefire talks have essentially collapsed in Cairo. Very ill-named ceasefire talks, I would say, because at no point, I think we can all agree in this, that at no point since the start of the ceasefire has this actually been, a ceasefire, right? A cessation of hostilities, because Israel has continued to kill people, has continued to drop bombs to fire on innocents. But now it's just a return to the status quo of what was, of what is the Israeli, the U.S.-supported Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. We are seeing also complete U.S. support for what's happening, right? Before I let you guys go on, I just want to highlight that the ceasefire in Gaza was started in January before Donald Trump comes into office, right? And now it has collapsed just about 2 months since he came into office. What we're hearing from White House officials is we fully support Israel. We are hearing, the Biden administration was making Israel fight with one hand tied behind their back. Now we have unleashed them to finish the job, etc. So sadly, this has become a bit of a never-ending tale, it seems, and in particular for those trapped inside Gaza, with no escape, with no safety, with no food, with no water, with no electricity, with nothing for but the hope that the next bomb that drops is not going to be, of them. So, having said that, what have you guys heard? What do you guys think about with the latest developments here in the there in the region?
Thanks, Esteban. I mean, for what you were saying about Trump, the only situation in which Trump would have been able to achieve a lasting deal is if Hamas had decided to unconditionally give up all of the captives in Gaza, and with no Palestinian prisoners being released in return, and also accept disarming. So since that is not the case, we see a resumption of this genocidal war, which is also part of implementing the American-Israeli vision for the region and Israel's sovereignty over all of Palestine. So we just got the news of Hossam, the Al Jazeera correspondent. I mean, I'm still in shock. But yeah, so as you said, after last week's episode, it resumed and they placed the blame on Hamas for not accepting Witkoff proposal, which was supposedly bridging phase one and phase two. And we don't know what it actually meant. I talked about this in the last episode, what that meant and what, what was the latest with the deal. So yeah, nearly 1,000 Palestinians murdered, and they're back to, in 1 week, they have deliberately targeted two hospitals. One of them they fully detonated, blew up. It's the Turkish Palestinian Friendship Hospital, which is the only specialized hospital for cancer in the Gaza Strip. And then yesterday they directly bombed Al Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, and a fire broke out. I think it was the second floor of the emergency building, and the Ministry of Health said that was like the surgical department of that section. So this is fully an American-Israeli war on Gaza. And the deputy U.S. Special Envoy, Morgan Ortegas, the famous Morgan Ortegas, who shook hands with the Lebanese president wearing the Star of David ring, said that the U.S. has unleashed Israel and provided it with all the weapons it needs to continue. Israel has reinvaded Rafah, or as they call it, expanded ground operations. And this has coincided with unbelievably heavy bombardment and besiegement. Palestinians have nowhere to go. They are, in every sense of the word, trapped.
Let me just jump in. The resumption of the ground invasion as well, right? Because Israeli troops have gone in and retaken the Tzadin corridor, where the infamous line of corpses resides.
For sure. For sure, exactly, yeah, exactly. Expanding to Rafah after having retaken the Netzarim corridor, which they had previously withdrawn from. So yesterday, the civil defense warned of a danger threatening the lives of over 50,000 citizens west of Rafah, where they were being besieged and shot at by the Israeli occupation forces. This was, I mean, we don't know how many people lost their lives here. And they claimed, you know, they issued evacuation orders, but then they opened fire at civilians who were fleeing after they issued those evacuation orders. And the Rafah municipality announced that thousands of families had been forced to flee Tel El Sultan neighborhood under intense bombardment. And crews, along with residents, were trapped in the area for hours. And these attacks are happening not only in Rafah or in the south or in Khan Yunis, but of course, north, central, and south. We have two members of Hamas's political bureau who were assassinated. One of them, Saleh al-Bardawil, along with his wife in his tent, killed during night prayers. And a bunch of other officials. They are not sparing anyone. Similar to Lebanon, they are not really sparing anyone at this point. And there is the overall understanding that Israel kind of took advantage of the time of the ceasefire to gather all this intel to be able to go after all of these Hamas officials and leaders that they had not previously gone after, you know? So the situation in Gaza is really unthinkable. And meanwhile, Israel has approved the formation of an oversight body or an agency that will oversee the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. You know, yesterday the security cabinet gave a green light to this plan by Israel Katz, the defense minister, to establish this new directorate under the defense ministry, which is tasked with enabling the voluntary departure of Palestinians from Gaza to third countries. So they are very serious about this, as much as some of us believe that they're not going to be successful with this. So according to the statement by the defense minister's office, the agency will coordinate safe and controlled passage, managing movement routes, pedestrian checks at Gaza crossings, and infrastructure for land, sea, and air transfers. And Katz openly linked this plan to Donald Trump's so-called peace vision, saying, "We are working to implement the U.S. president's vision, and we will allow any Gaza resident who wants to move to a third state to do so." But of course, rights groups are saying that this is not voluntary, and it does amount to forced displacement and violates international law. And the reality on the ground is clear. This is not about migration. It's about removing Palestinians from their land under the guise of choice. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said about Gaza, but I mean, I'll leave it there for now because there's so much happening. And it's just really getting exponentially worse. You know, yes. You have the wounded are dying, you know, because they have no access to any kind of care. And it's just beyond comprehension at this point.
The remaining healthcare professionals in Gaza have warned that anybody who has a serious injury is going to die. There is absolutely no way of treating them. This is a very stark reality of the situation inside there. I wanna point out also the you know, because the ceasefire talks were going over the weekend, and Jordan had a proposal to exile 3,000 members of Hamas out of Gaza. They don't actually say where, but you know, this is one of the proposals. The Egyptian proposal also was about the release of a number of U.S. Israeli captives, the cessation of hostilities for a few weeks. Again, you know, very, very vague. Because at the end of the day, how can you trust the Israeli government anymore to stand by any pledge that it makes? There's an obvious, and there has been, you know, let's be honest, there has been since October the 7th, since before, but let's say it's since October the 7th, 2023, there has been a very direct approach to Gaza, and that is kill them all, right? The children of Amalek, remember what they did to you. We were fighting human animals. You know, there's not going to be any aid entering Gaza, etc. This is simply the continuation of that same plan. I don't understand, you know, when you see some people almost in shock that this has happened again. You know, where were you for the past a year and a half? Where were you for the past several decades in any case?
Before we move into just like a brief picture of what's happening internally in Israeli politics, I also wanted to add that in the occupied West Bank, Israeli Security Cabinet also approved a proposal by, of course, the extremist Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, to separate 13 illegal settlements from their neighboring settlements and classify them as independent settlements. So this was approved, and he praised this formal recognition of these 13 new settlements in the occupied West Bank, and of course called it a major step towards normalization and effective sovereignty over the area, which is, again, what we're seeing here, a move to you know, apply sovereignty over the entire the entirety of Palestine. So for context, these areas that have now been granted independence were previously neighborhoods of existing settlements, but now gained administrative independence. And, you know, this comes in the context also of the approval of tens of thousands of housing units in the West Bank, or what Israel calls Judea and Samaria. So anyway, Netanyahu's cabinet recently has approved a no-confidence motion against the Attorney General, Israeli Attorney General, Gali Baharav Miara, who is Israel's chief legal advisor, just to explain. This happened yesterday, you know, and this comes as Israel's latest move on officials who are considered hostile to the government, defying protesters who have been taking to the streets for around 5-6 days now, actually. So yesterday, this no-confidence motion against the Attorney General was approved, and this comes after, of course, the attempt to remove the Shin Bet chief, Ronen Bar, who the Attorney General was also, you know, against removing. And so this was passed unanimously by ministers, although neither Netanyahu nor the Attorney General were present. And so now a special committee has to review the case, and I think legal hurdles are expected. But so basically the government accused Baharav Miara of consistently blocking government policies and labeling her actions as politically motivated. And the justice minister claimed that, you know, there's no longer trust between the government and its top legal advisor. And keep in mind, she's also been pushing for things like a proper October 7 investigation and things like that. So she didn't really stay silent. She warned that the government is trying to place itself above the law and vowed not to allow it. I mean, that's something we already know, that it sees itself as above the law and wants to bring this new Israel project into full effect. So mass protests erupted. These protests are the biggest we've seen since the judicial overhaul protests before
October 7th.
Mm-hmm. Right, in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv for the sixth straight day, thousands and tens of thousands gathered even outside the cabinet meeting as the vote happened. And I mean, this comes after also, like I said, trying to remove Ronen Bar, because Ronen Bar is also, you know, posing a nuisance to Netanyahu in several ways. One of them being that his agency is investigating this so-called Qatargate scandal, which is involves the financial links between Qatar and Netanyahu aides. Anyway, so, you know, this isn't about political disagreements. It's about undermining institutional checks in Israel. So, of course, the Israelis who believe that Israel is a democracy believe that this is a threat to Israeli democracy. And, you know, he's trying to oust these top officials because they get in the way of his vision for his project for what Israel is and what Israel is headed towards.
I mean,
so,
yes, let's be honest. His vision is, you know, his own impunity, right? Because I do not think there's a lot of interest from the Netanyahu family to protect the Israeli, you know, so-called democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East. No, it's about saving his ass. It has been, it's about saving his ass since the judicial overhaul, since his election, right? Since he runs for office to be elected essentially to skirt corruption charges to get some immunity. And it's just a continuation, right? And it's very interesting that Israeli democracy is so threatened by
because
these
the judiciary,
attacks. Yeah. Go ahead.
The judiciary is at a turning point because this is not like political turmoil only. It's like this is like Netanyahu, and not just Netanyahu, but, you know, at his camp. This is a targeted dismantling of the judicial system. So because these religious and ultranationalist groups, they view the courts as an obstacle to enforcing their religious law, right? So by replacing the Attorney General or whoever with someone who's loyal to their cause, then they're just trying to reshape the state from within. And, you know, Israel's judicial system has been about like a balancing act, like how to maintain the appearance of a democratic state, even though it's not, and to shield Israel from international backlash. And this has kind of collapsed now, you know, this has shattered. And so these protests are serious because they are like about the actual governance of Israel, not about like price hikes or whatever, like we saw in the past. And, you know, historically, whenever Israeli society was divided, killing Palestinians would unite them. But now even killing and displacing Palestinians and demolishing their homes doesn't serve as a unifying factor anymore. So there's no like rallying effect that we used to see in full, you know, gear. Like it's not working as well as it used to, you know. And this to go back to before we move on, everything we've just been talking about, this is like now we have, you know, these protests and then the genocide on the sidelines. So this is like a normalization of violence against Palestinians, you know, after 2 years of this carnage in the Gaza and the West Bank. Suffering has become background noise, And again, killing them doesn't unite the Israelis anymore. It's kind of falling apart at the seams in a way. Like, I don't know. This is the extreme. I don't know how much further it can go. This is really like the peak. So, you know, they don't fear Arab or international consequences. They can do whatever they want. And now they have these domestic crises unfolding. And really, the genocide and what's happening in the West Bank and everywhere else in the region is just background noise. And, you know, he's doing all these little things as distractions from the domestic crisis. And also, you know, that takes a number of different forms. So that's like where we are, really, with this.
It's very interesting what you said, right, that the about the consequences, because maybe there was a fear at some point in the Israeli democratic systems about some sort of consequence, but we know now that is not simply the case. Arab nations are just standing by and watching, except for one, which is Yemen, which maybe we can get into a bit later. But, you know, when you have the protection that you do as Israel, Yemen doesn't really... It doesn't pose that much of a threat, you know. Maybe many of our listeners will be completely disagreement with me, but you have the entire NATO apparatus, you have the entire Western militaries and intelligence services working for you. A nation, despite the bravery, despite the capacities that Yemen has demonstrated, I don't think, right, it's going to create much of an impact to change these things that we're seeing. I think the change is going to come internally, as you're saying, Sima, because this degradation has been happening for a while now, right? The fall of Israeli democracy. We have been reading about it in Israeli media for a long time, even before October 7, and everything just kind of became more compounded since then, as you say, right? Like they become united to do a genocide, but then at some point their own differences start to show up. What I wanted to ask you guys was, like I said, it's been 2 months since Trump came to power. Imagine that. It's been only 2 months. It's incredible to think everything that's happened since then. Benjamin Netanyahu, I read this very interesting article a few days ago on responsible statecraft, in which the author was essentially arguing that what Netanyahu is doing is portraying strength, right? Portraying himself to be a strong man within Israeli the system of power, right? The system of governance, by trying to dismiss the Shin Bet chief, by trying to dismiss the AG, by, you know, consolidating power around himself, etc., by sending, you know, planes to bomb Gaza indiscriminately in an attempt to, you know, not be seen as a loser, right? To not get a Zelensky treatment from Donald Trump. You know, I do not know if I agree entirely, because my view has always been that there is no wrong that Israel can do that the United States would not support, because history has shown us this. But Trump is, if nothing else, I think a disruptor, right? Maybe we will not agree with many things that the man stands for, but he is kind of marches to the beat of his own drum in many things. Do you guys think there's any possibility that... again, only 2 months in office, he still has 4 years to go. Is this going to be the story of the next 4 years? Is this going to be, you know, he has already sent $16 billion to Israel. Just Donald Trump has already sent $16 billion in 2 months. Is this going to be continued, right? Is this going to be the standard, $16 billion every 2 months? Is it going to be, you know, more troops? He's deploying more troops now, to more ships to the Red Sea to confront Yemen. Is there going to be any stop to this, right? Because for a while we saw Steve Witkoff and the other guy, Adam Bowler, you know, talking directly to Hamas, being very pressuring, right, the Israelis into the ceasefire. But now all of that seems to have disintegrated, and everybody has come right behind Netanyahu and said, we will back you to do whatever the hell you want. But again, is that going to be the story of the next 4 years, or are we maybe going to see a point in which all of this is going to shift and Benjamin Netanyahu is simply going to run out of cards? What do you guys think?
Yeah, well, I think, of course, regarding this issue, there's two major opinions. So either that two guys, Trump and Netanyahu, they will like fight each other because they are both have like big ego, and they might collide with each other. And there's another opinion that says that, as we know, the United States will do whatever Israel needs to do. I lean to the second opinion. The first opinion is more like Charmin. I lean to the second opinion. Both might be true also, because till now Trump is doing whatever Israel wants, and I think the Americans even offer Israel, you know, we can help you on this. Do you want us to do it? That's how I see the things. But also, Yani you said he's in, been in office to, yani 2-3 months, and he did all this. Yani Trump is not as. I'm not talking as the like people who like Biden and who like Hillary Clinton are talking, but it's true that the guy is not stable, and the guy is taking like some decisions that takes countries years to take or to rally upon. He's just signing it, so I don't know. Today he might like love Netanyahu, and maybe something will happen, like a voice note that somebody will publish. He might make him angry, but that doesn't mean that the United States or Trump will not continue aiding Israel. It means he might hate Netanyahu as a person, and they might find the new solutions. But till now, that's what we are seeing. Yani Biden made some coalitions. He targeted some points in Yemen. Okay, they did some damages, but they didn't kill a lot of civilians, at least. Trump, the first strike he did since he took office, he killed more civilians than Biden did in the recent 1.5 years. Yani he's like more cruel. He wants this. Yani he wants to show that Americans are tough and that America is number one. And one of his tools is to kill civilians in the Middle East. It's so obvious. If you don't see this, go read the news, go read the cradle. Yani, it's so obvious. That's what's happening now. What will happen in the next 24 hours, in the next year, we don't know. We have Netanyahu and Trump, and both are like, you can't expect anything from them. And you can't like say, okay, Netanyahu will do this or Trump will do this. Yani we have to wait and see. And unfortunately, there's no other players. Maybe people can predict things if you have more than one player. But currently you have one player and they are doing whatever they want. Yeah, nobody is stopping him. Is stopping them. Yani Russia has nothing to do with this. China has nothing to do with this. Saudi Arabia has nothing to do with this. It's very clear for the blind that Jordan and Egypt, Sisi, they are happy of what is happening. Currently, we have a proxy government in Lebanon. Yani we have a new Sisi in Lebanon, and we have a new King Abdullah in Lebanon. Now these are both ruling Lebanon. Yani our president and our prime minister are very similar to the rulers of Egypt and Jordan. They don't care about what's happening in Lebanon. They care that the Americans are smiling at the end of the day in their faces. So it's very difficult for us to know. And we have Syria. Syria, now we saw what's happening in Turkey. We'll talk more about Turkey, of course. But if Erdogan's hand is hurting, then the whole Syria is being hurt. So, and we have the only players in the region now. Trump and Netanyahu. We have to wait and see.
What do you think, Sima?
Yeah, I think it's. I can't know if for Trump's entire term he's going to burn down West Asia. Like, but it seems like he's willing to burn down West Asia. I don't see that. Again, I don't see that Trump would stop unless you see total submission on our side. Now, of course, some people would argue, even Karim, one of them, that, for example, Lebanon, by signing the ceasefire, that is submission. I agree with him. But I mean, like, 100% submission, like, from everyone, from Gaza, from Yemen. So why would Trump stop if he doesn't have total submission from all the players in West Asia? I don't see why he would stop. Until everyone's just subdued, really, and tamed, so that Israel feels better about itself and Israel can carry out its, you know, again, like if this Jewish state that wants to expand, not only expand its borders, but expand its settlement. It has, you know, illegal occupation as one of its national values, you know. I don't know. I don't see him calming down until we calm down and say, okay, fine, we give up.
We roll over. Yeah. Because, you know, just to get into Yemen a bit, because I don't want us to go too long into it. But Yemen has become the target of the U.S. War, of these very intense attacks that have been happening. We talked about it last week. Again, we know this is not going to resolve at the end of a gun. But there's also Iraq, right? Like Iraq is also been starting to get pressure to dismantle the PMU and all of these factions from Israel. But as Karim often puts it, right, Iraq is just going to do whatever is told. And then at the end of the list is Iran. right? With the letter from Trump to Khamenei and the threats that are continuing. We heard a few months ago that Israel was planning to launch attacks on Iran with the U.S. help in 6 months, right? They said by the fall, right? So, again, none of us here have a crystal ball, sadly, but the way things are going, it does seem like this has kind of become the status quo.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
The systematic destruction of Gaza's wastewater infrastructure is a calculated act of environmental warfare, pushing the region into an irreversible humanitarian and ecological crisis. The collapse of sanitation systems is not just a side effect of war. It is a deliberate strategy to make Gaza uninhabitable. Without urgent international intervention, the region will face long-term environmental devastation, increased disease outbreaks, and further humanitarian catastrophe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, 15 months of relentless Israeli regime assaults on Gaza have led to the complete collapse of wastewater infrastructure in the territory, deepening an already severe environmental and humanitarian catastrophe. The systematic targeting of wastewater treatment plants, pipelines, and pumping stations has severely curtailed sanitation services, exacerbating public health emergencies and accelerating environmental degradation. The Zionist regime's destruction of essential infrastructure in Gaza has created living conditions that threaten the survival of more than 2 million Palestinians. This aligns with the definition of genocide under Article 2C of the 1948 Genocide Convention, which prohibits acts intended to impose conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of a group. Prior to the 2023-2025 genocide, Gaza's wastewater infrastructure was already under severe strain due to the Zionist regime's blockade, which severely restricted access to essential materials and spare parts necessary for maintaining and upgrading wastewater treatment facilities, leading to outdated and poorly functioning systems. This situation was exacerbated by rapid population growth and political instability, resulting in the regular discharge of untreated wastewater into the Mediterranean Sea, thereby exposing millions of people to significant health and environmental hazards. By June 3, 2024, the situation had dramatically worsened as Israeli regime forces had demolished all water and sanitation warehouses in Gaza City and Khan Yunis, Gaza's two largest cities, while 70% of sewage pumps throughout the territory were destroyed. By June 2024, the destruction was total, with all wastewater treatment plants in Gaza wiped out. This systematic targeting of critical infrastructure has left millions of people without access to safe water and sanitation, fueling widespread disease outbreaks and accelerating environmental degradation. The absence of wastewater management has also severely impacted marine ecosystems, soil quality, and public health, turning Gaza into an uninhabitable zone. The collapse of wastewater treatment plants and sewage pumps has resulted in the uncontrolled discharge of raw sewage into the streets, agricultural lands, and water sources, contaminating the environment and accelerating the spread of disease. The World Health Organization reported already in November 2023 that damaged water and sanitation systems and limited access to cleaning supplies have made it nearly impossible to maintain basic infection prevention and control in health facilities. This has put tens of thousands of displaced and injured people at risk of infections and waterborne diseases. The destruction of Gaza's healthcare and sewage systems has triggered a severe public health crisis. In the first year of the war in Gaza, at least 669,000 cases of acute watery diarrhea were recorded, alongside more than 132,000 cases of jaundice, a key indicator of hepatitis, according to WHO. The collapse of sanitation infrastructure has resulted in widespread contamination of water sources, accelerating the spread of life-threatening diseases. More than 225,000 cases of skin diseases have been reported, alongside the spread of more than 1.1 million cases of acute respiratory infections as of October 17, 2024, according to WHO. Beyond the immediate health crisis, the destruction of wastewater systems is causing long-term environmental degradation. The uncontrolled release of sewage into the Mediterranean Sea threatens marine ecosystems, while groundwater contamination further limits Gaza's already scarce supply of clean drinking water. The shutdown of wastewater treatment plants has resulted in the daily discharge of approximately 130,000 cubic meters of wastewater into the Mediterranean, exacerbating pollution and increasing health risks. Without urgent intervention, these impacts will continue to endanger public health, food security, and the region's fragile environment. Efforts to rebuild wastewater infrastructure face significant obstacles. Ongoing Israeli regime assaults, material entry restrictions, and chronic fuel shortages hinder progress. The exact cost of repairing the wastewater infrastructure is not detailed separately, but is included in some estimates. The World Bank Group, European Union, and United Nations estimate that the total recovery and reconstruction cost for Gaza would exceed $53 billion. Short-term costs alone, calculated for just the first 3 years of reconstruction, total approximately $20 billion, according to their assessment published earlier this month. Without substantial international aid and technical support, Gaza cannot rebuild its wastewater system beyond patching a few pipelines or partially operating damaged treatment plants. The destruction is too severe, and the resources available within Gaza are insufficient to restore full wastewater management. The destruction of Gaza's wastewater infrastructure underscores the urgent need for a comprehensive and sustainable reconstruction plan. Advanced treatment technologies, local staff training, and international technical assistance are critical to building a resilient wastewater system. Immediate international action is also essential to halt the assault, ease restrictions on materials and funding, and ensure accountability for the destruction inflicted. Rebuilding Gaza's wastewater system requires an innovative and phased approach, given the systematic destruction of treatment plants, pipelines, and pumping stations. The systematic destruction of Gaza's wastewater infrastructure is a calculated act of environmental warfare, pushing the region into an irreversible humanitarian and ecological crisis. The collapse of sanitation systems is not just a side effect of war. It is a deliberate strategy to make Gaza uninhabitable. Without urgent international intervention, the region will face long-term environmental devastation, increased disease outbreaks, and further humanitarian catastrophe.
Winter takes its last breaths. The sun comes back to life and the earth gradually warms up. Trees awaken from their winter slumber and nature bursts forth in a symphony of vibrant colors. Spring is just around the corner. Everyone seems happy and full of hope. It is time to say goodbye to the cold season of the year and welcome a time marked by festivities across the country. During this beautiful transition, the people of Iran begin their preparations for Nowruz. Meaning New Day, this national festival is an ideal time for relaxation and rejuvenation, reconnecting with loved ones, traveling to breathtaking destinations, taking refuge in nature, and truly savoring life. This season grants everyone a precious opportunity to recharge their batteries for the year ahead. Yet, there is more about Nowruz, a festival with its roots in time immemorial. On the eve of the last Wednesday before Nowruz, Iranians traditionally celebrate Charshanbe Suri. People gather in neighborhoods to light bonfires made from wood and twigs. Participants jump over the flames while chanting Zardi man az to, Sorkhi to az man, which translates to, "My paleness is yours, your redness is mine." This chant symbolizes the hope for health and vitality in the new year. Setting off firecrackers and fireworks is a common practice to symbolically ward off evil spirits and announce the arrival of the new year with joy. Music, dancing, and singing often accompany the festivities, creating a lively atmosphere. The central message of Charshanbe Suri revolves around renewal and hope. It embodies themes of purification and the triumph of light over darkness. Welcome to Golestan Palace, a UNESCO World Heritage Site in the heart of Tehran, where history and culture come together to celebrate Nowruz, the Persian New Year. Nowruz, signaling the arrival of spring, is not just a celebration of nature's renewal, but also a reflection of Iran's rich heritage as well. Join us as we explore the significance of this beautiful festival and what it means to the people of Iran today. As the last moments of the old year fade away, families across Iran gather in their homes, ready to welcome the much-anticipated arrival of Nowruz, the Persian New Year. The air is filled with a palpable sense of excitement and hope as loved ones come together around the beautifully arranged haftseen table, which is a symbol of renewal and abundance. The haftseen table is meticulously set with seven symbolic items, each starting with a Persian letter seen, representing different aspects of life. Sabze, sprouted wheat or lentils symbolizing rebirth and growth. Samanu, a sweet pudding made from sprouted wheat representing power and strength. Senjed, dried fruit of the oleaster tree symbolizing love. Serke, vinegar representing patience and wisdom. Sir, garlic symbolizing health and protection against evil. Sip, apples representing beauty and health. Sumak berries symbolizing the sunrise and the triumph of good over evil. Alongside these, other elements such as a mirror, hyacinth, and coins are placed on the table, each carrying its significance. The declaration of the new year in Iran is not merely a change in time, it is a heartfelt ritual that encapsulates hope, love, and the promise of new beginnings. Surrounded by traditions and the spirit of renewal, each household becomes a part of a greater tapestry woven throughout the country, connecting all Iranians in a celebration of life and the beauty of new possibilities. Dr. Mostafa Pourali from Iran's Ministry of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts explained why Nowruz truly qualifies as a national festival.
As a national festival, what do you think are some of the social and cultural functions of Nowruz?
نوروز همون جوری که در پرونده ثبت میراث ناملموس جهانیش هم مورد تایید یونسکو قرار گرفته.
Nowruz transcends ethnic, religious and ideological differences. It serves as a unifying element among all our ethnic groups. In fact, it doesn't matter when the moment of the new year arrives. There's no distinction between Kurds, Lors, Gilaks, Arabs, Baluches and Persians. Everyone celebrates Nowruz. The same applies to the tradition of giving iftar during Ramadan. Even though iftar is associated with Ramadan, those who provide iftar do so for everyone, regardless of whether the recipient is fasting or not, or whether they're Muslim or not. What is important is the tradition of generosity and doing good deeds. When we talk about the cultural heritage of Iran, these are the elements that constitute it.
Nowruz has been celebrated for over 3,000 years, rooted in ancient Persian traditions. Here at the Golestan Palace, the echoes of history remind us how this festival transcends time, uniting generations. Nowruz is not just a holiday, it's a celebration of culture and identity, embraced by all Iranians, regardless of their background. Almost a week before the new year, we were strolling around the palace, captivated by its grandeur, when we stumbled upon a gathering of people relishing a duet. The performers were reciting verses from the Shahnameh, the epic masterpiece by Ferdowsi, one of the greatest poets of this land, whose work is deeply entwined with the themes of Iranian identity and heritage. What struck us was the abundant references to Nowruz throughout the Shahnameh, celebrating it as a festival of the Iranian nation.
Nowruz bude, hast va khahad bud.
Nowruz has been, is, and will continue to be as long as there exists a land called Iran on earth. This ancient festival connects the hearts of us Iranians. When Nowruz arrives, we visit each other, clean our homes, wear new clothes, and welcome freshness, light, and life.
Mohammad Reza Majuni, an Iranian naqqad or epic storyteller, told us about the mythological origins of Nowruz.
گرانمایه جمشید فرزند او، یعنی فرزند تهمورس دیوبند.
King Jamshid ascended to the throne after his father, King Tahmuras, and brought forth a plethora of innovations and inventions over the centuries, ranging from iron extraction and the creation of weapons to the development of clothing and the establishment of occupational groups, including four categories: priests, warriors, farmers, and artisans. He even crafted a throne that he would sit on and carried by demons ascend to the sky. When King Jamshid completed all his good deeds, the people of the world gathered around him, brings various gifts, and they celebrated with joy and happiness. King Jamshid named that day Nowruz, and thus laid the foundation for the Nowruz festival.
As we listened, one of the singers infused the performance with a modern melody brimming with patriotic fervor, weaving together the historical significance of Shahnameh with the contemporary expressions of love for Iran. As is tradition, shortly after the new year begins, Iranian TV channels air a speech by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. In this address, the leader reflects on the highlights of the past year and outlines the direction the country should take in the upcoming year. Additionally, he designates a theme for the new year, emphasizing a key priority for the nation. This year, for instance, the leader has named it Investment for Production in response to the country's specific circumstances.
This year, just like the past couple of years, the occurrence of Nowruz alongside Ramadan provides a unique opportunity for reflection and gratitude. As families celebrate the joys of the new year, they also observe the holy month of fasting. The juxtaposition of Nowruz's jubilant festivities with the spiritual solemnity of Ramadan invites Iranians to have both joy and contemplation.
نوروز 1404 مصادف شده با ماه مبارک رمضان.
This year Nowruz coincides with the holy month of Ramadan. In other words, we Iranians are celebrating our national festival Nowruz at the same time as we're fasting, observing a religious obligation. It's interesting to note that last year we registered the file for the global recognition of iftar and the social and cultural traditions associated with it in UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage list, in collaboration with several other countries. This means that the Ministry of Cultural Heritage has registered both Nowruz, which is a national element, and iftar, which is a religious one, on a global scale. The coincidence of these two provides a great opportunity to promote both. One of the good ideas that my colleagues have in mind for this year's Nowruz table is to adorn it with some elements from iftar tables and add certain sweets traditionally served during iftar. The Ministry of Cultural Heritage has also suggested a central slogan for this season, the Crescent of Nowruz, Nowruz in Ramadan, Iranian heritage. The harmonious coexistence of these two national and religious ceremonies is truly a cultural heritage of Iran that is being well preserved.
This unique overlap encourages a harmonious blending of joy and contemplation, inviting individuals to appreciate the blessings of a new beginning while embracing the deeper significance of their faith. The lively celebrations of Nowruz, marked by colorful gatherings, traditional dishes, and the exchange of well wishes, seamlessly complement the solemnity of Ramadan, where self-discipline and introspection take center stage. This dual celebration encourages Iranians to cherish their cultural heritage and spiritual values. For Iranians, these celebrations are not mutually exclusive, but rather complementary. They often find ways to celebrate the new year while observing the fast, creating a dialogue between festivity and spirituality. This synthesis of cultural and religious practices illustrates the rich Iranian identity. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the first day of the new year.
As a national festival, Nowruz serves multiple functions. It's a time for celebration, a moment for reflection, and an opportunity to strengthen familial and social bonds. Here at Golestan Palace, surrounded by splendor, we can truly appreciate the festival's role in fostering social harmony and cultural exchange. This Nowruz, as we welcome the first day of spring and the blessings of Ramadan, let's celebrate the beauty of unity in diversity. May the new year bring health, peace, and joy for all.
Nowruz is not only a celebration of spring, but also a powerful element in public diplomacy. As an intangible cultural heritage recognized by UNESCO in 2010, it holds the potential to promote understanding, cooperation, and connection among diverse nations and communities. We had a conversation with Dr. Alireza Delkhosh, currently serving as Iran's ambassador to Sri Lanka and the Maldives. He provided valuable insights into public diplomacy and its connection to Nowruz.
How do you assess the role of Nowruz in fostering public diplomacy in the region?
Diplomacy umumi yek shive novini az diplomacy.
Public diplomacy is a novel approach to diplomacy. It refers to a set of efforts and activities undertaken by governments or institutions to communicate and influence public opinion in other countries. Its aim is to improve the national image, raise awareness of culture and values, and foster positive relationships with foreign people and media. In this light, Nowruz can be seen as a tool in the hands of public diplomacy. Nowruz can serve as a bridge connecting nations. The nations that celebrate Nowruz focus on their cultural commonalities rather than geographical, political, or ethnic divisions. The Nowruz celebration that these nations observe simultaneously, along with traditions that share many similarities, has allowed Nowruz to create a cultural geography composed of various countries, bringing nations closer together in the simplest way possible.
Nowruz transcends national borders, celebrated by various ethnic groups across the West Asia region, Central Asia, the Caucasus, and beyond. This shared heritage provides a unique platform for cultural exchange, inviting countries to engage in dialogue, share traditions, and explore common values.
Can you tell us what other countries celebrate Nowruz other than Iran?
Many countries around the world celebrate Nowruz. Officially, it is recognized in 13 countries: Iran, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, India, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, Iraq, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkey. However, it is worth mentioning that in other countries, while not all people, many groups do celebrate Nowruz, ranging from India and China to Balkan nations like Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Moreover, the themes of renewal and hope inherent in Nowruz can serve as a foundation for peace-building initiatives. The holiday emphasizes the importance of harmony and friendship, making it an ideal occasion for diplomacy aimed at fostering better relations between nations, especially in regions experiencing conflict. Events and festivals celebrating Nowruz can also facilitate grassroots diplomacy. By organizing cultural events, workshops, and community gatherings, nations can create opportunities for citizens to interact, learn from each other, and cultivate mutual respect and understanding.
The message of Nowruz is undoubtedly one of peace and friendship. Just as the United Nations has designated a day to celebrate Nowruz, this festival does not solely belong to Iran and this region. In fact, Nowruz belongs to humanity. Everyone should celebrate it, and if some countries do not observe it, it may be because they are unaware of it. Nowruz truly promotes nothing but peace and friendship among individuals and among nations.
This ancient festival can easily attract visitors and therefore can promote cultural tourism. Countries can use this holiday to showcase their unique customs, cuisine, and traditions, thus enhancing bilateral relations through economic cooperation in areas like tourism, trade, and cultural industries.
My next question is regarding foreign tourists. Do you have any specific recommendations for them visiting Iran during the Nowruz celebrations?
In our national development program, there has been special attention to tourism. The overall policy is to provide better hosting for foreign tourists, so that they leave the country with greater satisfaction and more pleasant memories. My suggestion to tourists coming from abroad is not to limit themselves to a few famous cities in Iran, like Shiraz and Isfahan, which are indeed jewels of our history and civilization, but to explore the many attractive cultural and natural areas that remain unknown to tourists. It would be a pity for them to come to Iran and miss visiting these regions, which range from Hyrcanian forests in the north, registered as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, to the caravanserais scattered throughout Iran, some of which date back hundreds of years, and are also included in the UNESCO World Heritage List. By the way, these caravanserais are located in 24 provinces across the country. By visiting various and sometimes lesser-known areas, tourists can have a richer and more unique experience during their travels in Iran.
In Iran, the Nowruz holidays span 13 days. On the 13th day of the new year, known as Sizebedar, literally meaning getting rid of the 13th in Farsi, Iranians traditionally go outdoors to appreciate nature and enjoy picnics. It's common to bring along the sabze, sprouted wheat or lentils, from the half-seen table and throw it into flowing water, symbolizing the disposal of bad luck. A charming custom associated with this day involves young, single individuals, particularly girls, tying up leaves from the greenery before discarding it as a hopeful gesture for finding a partner. As Nowruz draws to a close, Iranians transition from the vibrant celebrations of the new year back to their daily routines, rejuvenated and full of energy. Mr. Majuni reminiscent about his childhood experiences during Nowruz emphasizing the importance of preserving the festival's rituals.
پدرم هر زمان هر ساعتی از شبانه روز که موقع هنگام سال تحویل بود ما رو بیدار می‌کرد.
Every year when the new year arrived, even if it was midnight, my father would wake us up and say we should sit around the half-seen table. Then he would hug us, congratulate us on the new year and give us our gifts. I will never